From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, on this 100th anniversary of her birth, we examine the legacy of Rosa Parks and that historic moment on a Montgomery, Alabama bus.
We like to think of this being a spontaneous thing. Maybe she was too tired. None of that was true. She was ready for it, and when the opportunity presented itself, she seized it.
And we will examine our own attitudes towards immigrants.
Most Americans, both wealthy and working class, oppose working class immigrants more than wealthy immigrants.
And as the Affordable Health Care Act opens up Medicaid to nearly 500,000 more people in Michigan, Governor Snyder must decide who is going to foot the bill. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This is the 100th birthday of civil rights leader Rosa Parks. We talk today with history professor Danielle McGuire about the legacy of Rosa Parks. And we take you inside the bus where she refused to give up her seat to a white man in Montgomery, Alabama. That simple act of courage helped spark the civil rights movement in America. And with immigration reform high on the agenda in Washington, D.C., we look at just what makes people think the way they do about undocumented immigrants. But first, is the state of Michigan going to expand its Medicaid coverage? That's the question on the front burner at the governor's office these days as he prepares to unveil his new budget to the legislature this week. Joining us now from the Detroit Free Press is reporter Kathleen Gray. Welcome.
Hi, Cindy.
Well, there are about 1.9 million Michiganders getting Medicaid benefits right now. So why are another 500,000 potentially eligible?
Well, under the Affordable Care Act, which everybody knows is Obamacare now, it makes about 500,000 more Michiganders eligible for the Medicaid expansion. They are raising the poverty level up to 133%. Instead of just 100% of poverty level. And that allows, I think it's 470,000 more citizens to be eligible for Medicaid if the state decides to expand.
And that, and you say the word if, which means it's not a requirement of the state to do this. It just says eligibility is expanded. It's up to the states?
That's right. That's right. And I think that there's 22 states that have not decided yet if they're going to expand. The federal government will pay 100% of the cost for 3 years, but after that, it's up to the states to pick up about 10% of the cost, which is, you know, no small amount of money. It's estimates between $150 to $250 million or $300 million a year just for that 10%.
Ooh, so that has to be a big, big consideration, trying to look into that financial fiscal crystal ball and see what things might be like in 2020.
Right.
So what's the mood in Lansing right now as far as their support in the legislature to get this expanded Medicaid through?
I think that there's some support in the legislature. I think that in their heart of hearts, a lot of people want everybody to be able to get the Medicaid. But there's also a real distrust about Obamacare in certain circles, and they really there are some Republicans who just don't want to buy into it in any sense. And if that means expanding Medicaid, they're just not going to do it. So I think it's definitely going to have a hard road when it comes up in the legislature.
What is Governor, I know Governor Snyder's got to make this decision as he's putting his budget together. What is he hearing from doctors and hospitals?
A study just came out last week from the University of Michigan that said that the doctors would be able to provide for those additional people. And that was a big concern for Governor Snyder. And his office started saying last week that they're more comfortable with the ability of doctors and hospitals to be able to treat those people. But again, it's a matter of whether or not you've got the money to be able to do it in the long run.
Do you think that the doctors and the hospital administrators are of the mindset of, hey, let's take that federal money if they're offering 100% at least for a while, take it and see where we're at in 2020?
I think that that's part of it, but there's also the consideration of kind of do no harm. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to be able to get as many people in as you can, and it's going to be a heck of a lot less expensive if you can get people into a doctor's office instead of them having to go to an emergency room, which is happening so often now. With people who are uninsured.
If Governor Snyder decides to forego the expansion, then it sounds like the ones who will be paying the price are the uninsured people that by law have to find the health care.
That's right. And if they're employed, their employers might find some fines being levied against them. So it's going to be up to those individuals or their employers on how they go out and get insurance. And, you know, insurance is not cheap.
Yeah. Kathleen, what are you going to be watching for now? I know that he'll unveil his budget on Thursday, but just kind of looking ahead at this issue, what are you looking for?
Well, I'm looking for if he's actually going to go ahead with the expansion. He hasn't tipped his hand yet on that. He's becoming more comfortable with some aspects of it, but there's still the financial hurdle, and there's a huge political hurdle too. So I think that it's gonna say a lot about Governor Snyder on which way he goes with this particular Medicaid expansion.
What kind of voices are being raised just on behalf of people? I mean, we've talked a little about thoughts in the legislature and what doctors and hospitals are saying, but is there a large degree of awareness of this and support for this amongst the people of Michigan?
I don't think that there's necessarily much awareness of it. There are 20 to 30,000 people now who are eligible for Medicaid and who aren't getting it. And if there are people out there who are eligible and not signing up for it, then I think that there's an even bigger general unawareness of this particular issue. And you know, for people who haven't been insured for many, many years, there often are other issues involved. There's sometimes mental illness involved. There's sometimes substance abuse involved. And the only way that they're going to become aware of it is if different agencies and other groups that have some outreach and education out there for them to be able to learn about these programs.
So it sounds like Thursday with the budget address will be the unveiling of the decision.
Yes, it will. You know, and I'm sure it'll probably leak out before then on Wednesday or something like that. But we'll be watching them. Well, we'll be there on Thursday.
Kathleen, thanks for talking with us today.
Sure. Thank you, Cynthia.
Kathleen Gray is a reporter from the Detroit Free Press. There has been a change of heart, or at least of policy, at Michigan's Secretary of State's office. Word came down late last week that thousands of children of undocumented immigrants in Michigan will now be eligible for a driver's license or an official state ID. That was quite a reversal of the stand that had been taken by Michigan Secretary of State Ruth Johnson. She now says a review of new federal guidelines convinced her to change the policy. Joining me now is Miriam Aukerman, staff attorney with the ACLU of Michigan. She joins us from their Grand Rapids office. Hi, Miriam.
Hi, happy to be here.
Well, just to be clear, tell us exactly who are the people that this decision affects?
These are young immigrants who came to the United States as children. They're people who grew up in Michigan, went to our schools, played on our playgrounds, grew up alongside our own kids, and have only ever known Michigan as home. They have to have come to this country before they were the age of 16. And in June of last year, the federal government developed a new program to allow these young immigrants deferred action, basically the ability to stay in this country lawfully for a period of time. That's who this group is. It's about 15,000 young people in Michigan.
And I know they're called DREAMers. What does that acronym stand for?
It's based on federal legislation, the DREAM Act, which is was to provide comprehensive immigration relief to these young immigrants. The DACA program is more limited and is basically a stopgap measure until we reach the goal of having more comprehensive immigration relief for these young individuals. But the movement of these young immigrants is often called the DREAMer. They call themselves the DREAMers.
What was the reason for denying the licenses?
Well, the Secretary's position was that under Michigan law, individuals must be legally authorized to be present in the United States authorized under federal law to be present in the United States. And our position was, if you're authorized to work here, which DACA beneficiaries are, if you're authorized to work here and you're authorized to live here, you're also authorized to be present here. But the secretary thought that the federal immigration law was unclear and therefore that she could not issue licenses. So we met with her in November, set out our legal concerns in great detail, but she continued to disagree with us on what the law meant, and then we proceeded to file the lawsuit. What happened is, that about 2 weeks ago, the federal government issued guidelines that made what we thought was clear, absolutely crystal clear. Those guidelines specifically say that DACA beneficiaries are legally authorized to be present. We thought that had been clear all along, but that was even clearer in light of those guidelines, and so the secretary reversed course. I think sometimes when you're driving in the wrong direction, you know it's time to make a U-turn.
And so now what do you see next? What are you looking for next?
Well, I think, you know, this resolves the issues in the litigation because we have exactly what we hope to get, which is licenses, personal identification cards for these young immigrants. And I think the secretary has made the change that we've requested. So in terms of the litigation, that resolves it. But I think sort of the larger question is really how this plays into the fact that we have a broken immigration system, the fact that you have individuals who grew up here who have lived here basically their entire lives, who are part of our communities, who have so much talent and are yet being excluded. Now we have the opportunity through comprehensive immigration reform to fix that broken immigration system, and I think these young people are really the prime example of why that's so necessary.
And just for practical questions for anyone listening who may be affected by this, does this go into effect right away? Can they go to the Secretary of State's office and apply for their driver's license?
It goes into effect February 19th, and they're going to be issuing a new type of license, a limited license that reflects the length of time that the person has legal presence authorization. So if a person is authorized under federal law to be here for 2 years, under the Deferred Action Program, the license would be good for 2 years.
Thanks so much, Miriam.
Thank you so much.
Miriam Ackerman is a staff attorney with the ACLU of Michigan. She joined us from Grand Rapids. Coming up, today marks the 100th birthday of civil rights icon Rosa Parks. And we'll take you inside the bus where Parks refused to give up her seat to a white man in Montgomery, Alabama in 1955. That simple act of courage helped to spark the civil rights movement in America. That story comes up in 15 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of Rosa Parks, small in stature, said by all who knew her to be quiet and humble, yet a woman who made a giant mark on the pages of American history, a woman hailed as a true icon of the civil rights movement. Here's Parks in an interview with the Academy Achievement in 1995, 10 years before her death, describing just what led to her arrest in 1955 in Montgomery, Alabama, heart of the South of Jim Crow laws.
Well, I was arrested on December 1st, 1955, for refusing to stand up on the orders of the bus driver after the white seats had been occupied in the front. And, of course, I was not in the front of the bus, as many people have ridden and spoken that I was, that I got on the bus and took a front seat, but I did not. I took a seat that was just back of where the white people were sitting. And in fact, the last seat, and the man was next to the window, and I took an aisle seat, and there were two women across. And we went on undisturbed until about the second or third stop, when some white people boarded the bus and left one man standing. And when the driver noticed him standing, he told us to stand up and let him have those seats. He referred to them as front seats. And when the other three people, after some hesitancy, stood up, he wanted to know if I was going to stand. I told him I was not, and he told me he would have me arrested. I told him he may do that. And, of course, he did.
That deliberate, well-thought-out act of civil disobedience galvanized the struggle for civil rights, not only here in America, but around the world. A year later, in 1956, Rosa Parks and her husband Raymond moved to Detroit, and that's where she lived until her death in 2005. Let's take a closer look at the life and legacy of Rosa Parks as we welcome Wayne State University Professor of History Danielle McGuire, who joins us now from the Rosa Parks Celebration, the National Day of Courage, at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thinking back on this 100th birthday of Rosa Parks, can you give us your sense as a historian where this woman stands in American history?
Well, Rosa Parks has become an icon of American history, sainted and celebrated by almost everyone. The unfortunate thing is that we only remember a small portion of her life, you know, that moment in December of 1955 when she refuses to give up her seat to a white man on a segregated Montgomery bus. But she was so much more than that. And I think, you know, given the celebrations today at the Henry Ford Museum and all around the country in honor of her 100th birthday, we're learning a whole lot more about her.
Give us a bigger sense then of what's been overlooked, and you know, as we focus on that Montgomery bus in 1955, what more are we overlooking?
Well, leading up to the bus boycott, Rosa Parks was a seasoned activist. And we all know that she was secretary of the NAACP for a decade before the bus boycott, but that didn't mean that she filed papers away or just took notes. What it meant was that she was a detective for the NAACP, and her job was to interview victims of racial violence, to interview survivors of racial terrorism. And she did that very quietly, usually under the cover of darkness, at great risk to her own life. And she brought those testimonies back to the Montgomery chapter, where they then decided whether or not to pursue a protest or launch a campaign. Mm-hmm. And it's those campaigns that Rosa Parks helped to launch in the 1940s, particularly her work on a rape case of a black woman named Recy Taylor, that really allowed her to cut her political teeth and help her build relationships that built the infrastructure necessary to launch something as successful as the bus boycott.
So it seems to me, Danielle McGuire, that as we look at what was leading up to that moment in December 1955, she was the right person at the right time, wasn't she?
She was exactly the right person at exactly the right time. And Rosa Parks, you know, when she was arrested that day, she knew exactly what would happen to her, and she did it anyway. She knew that the arrest could trigger a beating, could mean that she would be killed in the custody of the police. I mean, this has happened before, and she had investigated those cases before, but she did it anyway. And, you know, we like to think of this being a spontaneous thing. Maybe she was too tired. None of that was true. She was ready for it, and when the opportunity presented itself, she seized it.
I did see some quote where she apparently was rather annoyed at that idea that she was this tired seamstress who just didn't want to. She was too physically tired. She said, no, I was tired of being tired. That's
exactly
a tough voice speaking, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And she carried that voice throughout her life, and she had courage throughout her life. I mean, it took courage to, you know, defy segregation. It took courage to protest police brutality in Detroit. It took courage to protest the war in Vietnam, which she did. It took courage to protest all of these things that she did throughout her 70 years as an activist.
And I think that's, as you say, that it isn't as if she did this deed in December of 1955 and then kind of went onto the shelf.
Right, and she could have. That's the thing. Yeah. She could have. You know, she was harassed. She had death threats hurled at her all the time in Montgomery, and she left, and she could have receded into the woodwork, you know. Mm-hmm. But she didn't. She continued to struggle for dignity and human equality.
What brought her to Detroit?
Well, her brother lived here, for one thing, and mostly she was pushed out of Montgomery. You know, the harassment started immediately after she waged her protests on the bus, and then death threats began. She actually petitioned the Montgomery Improvement Association's leaders, you know, Martin Luther King and others, for night watchmen at her home because she felt so threatened. And her brother was so worried that she'd be killed in Alabama that he urged her to come to Detroit, and she finally felt, you know, unsafe enough that she left.
I think for many people who might be listening to us, especially younger people, they would see a picture of her in the Free Press or the news at some event, and there'd be this little tiny grandmotherly looking gray-haired lady. But what was she really, really like? Is people would encounter her, particularly not at some event or not at some opening, but in her day-to-day life and in working for Congressman Conyers and just living in Detroit, what kind of person was she?
Well, I never got to meet her, but from what I've heard from the people who did is that she was a quiet woman. She was very soft-spoken. She was very unassuming. She wasn't the kind of radical activist who shouts out from a rooftop, you know, their plans and their protests. She did her work very slowly, methodically, but she did it every single day. And, you know, most people who know what she did in Detroit would call her a revolutionary, a quiet revolutionary, yes, but a revolutionary. And I think that's the most important thing to remember about her, is that she, you know, you don't have to bang drums and launch, you know, a huge campaign. You can do this kind of work every single day over many days and months and years and make a serious change in America, the kind of change that the whole world is now honoring and celebrating.
As you study her life and her years here in Detroit after she left Montgomery, first, I guess it's a two-part question. Did she get the respect from other civil rights leaders that was owed to her? Meaning there were a lot of pretty powerful, manly personalities. Did they respect her as she deserved?
Well, you know, we have to remember that a lot of the male civil rights leaders were men of the time, mm-hmm. and they had their own gendered assumptions about women's roles in the world. And, you know, Martin Luther King not excluded in that sense. Black women who were involved in the civil rights movement talked about the sexism they encountered from those leaders, including Martin Luther King. I think Rosa Parks was denied the opportunity to really be the kind of leader that she was, particularly after the boycott began. Of course, you know, she ran E.D. Nixon's office in Montgomery, and she worked for him in so many different levels. And you know, he often said women's roles are in the kitchen, and she said, well, what about me? Mm. You know, you wouldn't get anything done with that if I was in the kitchen. So I think she got used to people treating her like...
Was she a little bit taken for granted, do you
think?
Oh,
totally. Yeah. She was totally taken for granted. And I think not recognized for the work that she did over many, many years, and not recognized for the groundwork that she laid, the foundations that she laid, so that people like King could come along and then help to organize a campaign. You know, none of that would have been possible without the decades of activism that Rosa Parks put in first.
And then the other part of my question, do you feel that she was aware of her position as an icon?
Yeah, I'm confident that she was aware of it, and confident that she, in many ways, played to it. You know, she didn't spend a lot of time talking about her activism in Detroit. She didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about the other work she did, partly because she knew people just wanted to talk about the bus and, you know, her singular stand against segregation. And she catered to them. I don't know why exactly, but she did. And then she went about her work, you know, for dignity and justice. She's a fascinating woman, fascinating, courageous, bold, defiant, quiet, unassuming. You know, in some ways she's a study of opposites, and yet she fundamentally transformed America.
We're talking with Danielle McGuire, who's an assistant professor of history at Wayne State University, on this 100th birthday of Rosa Parks. And as you have studied the civil rights movement, Danielle, what do you feel that, especially the youngsters of today, what can they take away, or all of us really, take away from the life of Rosa Parks?
We need to understand that Rosa Parks was a warrior for justice, not one day, not one moment, not one time, but all the time. That whenever she encountered injustice, she spoke out about it. She did something about it. She asked questions. She criticized. She critiqued. You know, she got involved. And this is something we can do. She was just like us, an ordinary person with not a whole lot of resources, probably fewer resources than most of us, who had more strikes against her than most of us have today. And yet she was able to wage war, really, against white supremacy and inequality. And we can do that. That's something we can do easily, whether we're sitting in front of our computer or walking through the world. We can model her actions every day by having the courage to speak out against injustice.
And it is quite remarkable. I saw a quote from Congressman John Conyers that said, in all the years she worked for him and that he knew her, her voice was not raised. She was just kind of quietly present. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to foam at the mouth and
exactly.
and shout, right?
And, you know, in some ways, I think you can get more done that way. And she certainly would have been a surprise to some of her enemies. I mean, even people now who embrace her and embrace the idea of her would be surprised to know that, you know, as Jean Theo Harris, the author of a great new book about Rosa Parks, talks about that, you know, that her hero was Malcolm X and that she supported black power movements. I mean, this is really important to know about Rosa Parks, but she didn't, you know, pump her fist and wear black leather coats and wear berets and carry guns around threatening whitey. But she was in favor of, you know, black power. So, yeah, you can do this quietly and be really effective. I think that's what she teaches us.
She died in 2005. So in those years since, do you think that the civil rights struggle in America and really around the world, has it continued to progress, or would she be disappointed with where we are today?
I think that coming up in Alabama during the era of Jim Crow, she would recognize that we have made significant progress. She would recognize that. She would have to. But she would also see that we have significant work left to do, that we still have schools that are segregated and unequal, that we still have a problem with police brutality, that we still have a huge and growing problem that is mass incarceration, that you know, she would be very interested in the problem of human trafficking all around the world on a global level. She would be opposed to the wars that we're involved in and war everywhere. So I think that she would realize, you know, as other civil rights activists put it, that freedom is a constant struggle, that you know, it's a journey that we all have to participate in. And in some cases, it's not a journey that ends, but we can definitely make a difference by, you know, walking in her footsteps and working to make freedom more possible each day.
Professor Danielle McGuire from Wayne State University, author of the book At the Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
The Montgomery, Alabama bus that was the setting for Rosa Parks' historic refusal to give up her seat is now enshrined at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn. Visitors ranging from the tiniest child to President Barack Obama have sat in that bus seat reflecting on the woman and the act. Stateside's Emily Fox visited the Henry Ford Museum, talking with visitors and with the museum's Christian Overland.
We're standing inside with Liberty Justice for All exhibition inside Henry Ford Museum, and we're standing next to the most significant artifact and icon of the civil rights movement, and that's Rosa Parks' bus. Rosa Parks' bus, it's a General Motors bus that was built in Flint, Michigan. It's number 2857, and it's the bus in which she sat down on December 1st, 1955, and then she stood up for everybody's rights by sitting down. I mean, it's an artifact that people actually can get into, too. You can actually sit in Rosa Parks' chair, the bus seat, and hear her story from her own words.
Let's get on the bus. We're holding everybody up.
The time had just come when I had been pushed as far as I could stand to be pushed, I suppose. I had decided that I would have to know once and for all what rights I had as a human being and a citizen, even in Montgomery, Alabama.
Rosa Parks has shown us how to start our journey. We had a lot more work to do to assure our civil rights and to enjoy the full expression of freedom.
And we have to remember that we can't take things for granted. We don't want to go back to where we were.
Racism is still alive today. In my lifetime, as I went as a kid, I went into the gas stations and saw the white and black and asked my dad, what's that about? I grew up in Lansing, Michigan, and we would go to Texas every year, and so as we got down to the South, that's what we would see. When people do something, they don't realize how important it is. If she hadn't have done it, we have no idea what would have happened. But she didn't realize it was a big deal. She was just doing what she thought was right, period.
That was a big movement that day when it started everything, you know, the civil rights movement, everything.
In that terrible segregation.
Rosa Parks, she stood up when other people weren't standing up.
It's a blessing that she stood up for, like, black history and gave us the rights to get in front of the bus. So I just want to thank her, and it's a blessing.
I would just thank her for everything that she did. She's definitely monumental.
So I would say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
And that was prepared by Emily Fox. Here at Stateside, we always want to hear from you. What stories do you want to hear more about? What people do you want us to profile? Let us know. Find us online at michiganradio.org. You can click on the link that says Stateside. And we're on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And of course, we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Still to come, with immigration reform high on the national agenda in Washington, D.C., we're going to look at just what makes people think the way they do about undocumented workers.
People think of Latinos when they think of new immigrants in this country, so their feelings about that particular group drive their overall feelings about immigration.
That's coming up next, right here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For the very first time in more years than just about anyone can remember, things appear to be lining up in Washington in favor of immigration reform. President Obama has his framework for reform on the table, and the bipartisan group of senators, now dubbed the Gang of Eight, has put its framework out there. The senators say they hope to introduce legislation in March or April and then hold a vote by late spring or early summer. The action on the federal front has prompted Governor Snyder to release his own statement on immigration reform. Among his words, he says, "For America to be competitive in the 21st century, it's critical that we implement an effective system for legal immigration. Our current immigration system is inflexible and broken. It has hurt our economy." So that's what our governor has to say. Let's get a deeper look at the immigration reform debates, especially as they happen here in Michigan, as we welcome Democratic State Representative Rashida Tlaib. She represents the 6th House District, and we should let those of you who aren't familiar with Southeast Michigan understand that's located in southwest Detroit. It stretches from an area south of downtown to the city's southern border and then west of the city of Dearborn. She joins us from Lansing. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you very much for having me.
And from the University of Michigan, we have Professor of Political Science Nick Valentino joining us in the studio. Hi, Nick. Good to have you here. Well, Representative Rashida Tlaib, I'd like to start with you, if I could, because you represent an area that is so impacted by the debate on immigration reform. What were your thoughts of what you're seeing in Washington, both with the president's ideas and the bipartisan Senate framework?
You know, it reminds me of about 6 or 7 years ago. This is exactly where we were, and having a conversation about comprehensive immigration reform. At that time, I was an organizer working with some of the local churches on the issues and the impacts of the broken immigration system. So it reminds me of the moment where everyone was talking about the importance of fixing our immigration system because it defines who we are as a nation and the feeling of bipartisanship. And then, obviously, towards the end of that debate came the details of the legislation and some, obviously, challenges that prevented it from moving forward. I was in the basement of a church, St. Gabriel's in southwest Detroit. We have 20 different ethnicities in our community, and so immigration has been a top issue among families and their quality of life. And many of them are very fearful that this might not be a successful movement, just like they saw 6 and 7 years ago.
Well, let me ask you then, Nick Valentino, is there anything different politically in the climate today versus some years ago, as the representative had cited? Getting that bipartisan effort on the table, I think, encouraged some, but the devil's in the details.
Well, I think that's right. One of the interesting things that happened as a result of the 2012 presidential election is that both parties started to realize that there are both economic and symbolic roots and causes of people's attitudes about immigration. And so just to really quickly describe those, on the economic side, you might imagine that people would oppose immigration because they felt that their own American citizens might oppose new immigrants because they might feel their own jobs would be at risk. They would be competing with lower wage immigrant laborers. Or you might imagine that wealthier Americans might oppose new immigrants because they might pose a social welfare burden that we would all have to foot the bill for. And so it might be those groups that would oppose. And those are the economic sources that some people have pointed to of opposition to immigration. But on the other side of the debate are these concerns about who the immigrants are, the symbolic forces, like feelings about outgroups and others that might be coming to the United States that we don't understand, that might change our culture, that might change our language. And actually, when we've done research on this repeatedly, what we found is it's that latter category of forces that seem to be much more important for predicting who's going to support and who's going to oppose new immigrants. And so that's the academic consensus, I think, at this point, is that these symbolic forces of who the immigrants are in particular, are they going to threaten our culture? Are they going to change who we are as Americans? Are they different than we are? Is a much bigger force driving the average American's viewpoint about who should be allowed to come.
More so than a pocketbook wallet economic.
Exactly. More so than whether immigrants will lower your own wage, whether they will compete with you. We find those are very, very small predictors, actually, of whether you support new immigration reforms, making it easier to become a citizen or a path to citizenship. So we found that that's one really important set of findings that we keep getting over and over again, both in our surveys that we do of national samples of Americans, and also when we present in an experimental setting, when we present people with vignettes describing particular immigrants, what we find is that, well, we find two things. One, most Americans, both wealthy and working class, oppose working class immigrants more than wealthy immigrants. So there is this notion of opposition to lower wage immigrants more than wealthy ones. That's across the spectrum, even among wealthy Americans who might, you know, compete against those, say, engineers or high tech workers who might be coming from other countries. Everyone seems to support higher wage skilled immigrants much more than working class immigrants. So that's one finding. But the other finding that we get is that different groups of Americans feel very differently about specific groups of immigrants.
Such as?
For example, when most Americans think about immigrants, they think about Latinos. This isn't a general ethnocentric view that any new person coming from any country will be a problem. In the United States, for perhaps some reasons we could speculate about, and it's not just because they're the largest group of incoming new citizens, people think of Latinos when they think of new immigrants in this country. So their feelings about that particular group drive their overall feelings about immigration.
Which would then spill over. I know you just referenced Representative Tlaib. You were with 20 different ethnicities in that meeting at that church. So that's spilling over, if you will, into the view of all would-be citizens?
Yes. You know, it was very interesting because you had me, a Palestinian child of immigrants, Palestinian American, and a state senator who was born in Korea. And we were there talking about how we can, you know, change the mindset of Americans across the country and across even our state about what it means to have immigration reform. One thing that, and I know the professor would agree, is that everyone is in agreement that our immigration system is broken. Mm-hmm. When people say, hey, you have to get in line, I always say there is no line. And that is something that I think folks that are actually working within the immigration system, some of the even advocates and attorneys that represent immigrant families from all over the world, will tell you that the system is not meeting the needs of this generation, the needs of our country, and it works against uniting families versus keeping them together. And so one of the issues that did come up, that's where we can start with, is that the immigration system is broken. And we all agree we have to fix it. It's the disagreement comes when we try to go into the details of how to fix it. One of the things that did come up is trying to build better and stronger relationships with the African-American community. In my district, that's when it comes up. It is, you know, brown versus black in regards to the workforce. And how do we unite that movement in trying to say we all deserve good paying jobs? I'm not trying to take your job, and you are not trying to take my job. These are not, in many ways, neighbors that just, you know, these are not people that just have come over across a so-called wall. I mean, that's kind of the stereotype you hear. But these are people that have been living among us. They've been our neighbors. Their children go to school with my children. They've been here for years, 10, 11, 12 years. Many of them have applications within the U.S. Immigration system, but are still waiting for their turn to be able to obtain the documents that give them the legal status.
The representative mentioned something I think that's really important and ties back into what happened in the presidential election. And that is we've also recently been finding very clear evidence that African Americans in the United States, even though on average they do compete more intensely with new immigrants for jobs and wages, are on average more tolerant of new immigrants than other groups, including Anglo-Americans. They are more tolerant of new immigrants, and we think that is in part because they can sympathize and empathize with the treatment that new immigrants might be getting. And that sympathy for the kind of treatment they may say see as negative treatment in the current regime, actually might drive a kind of group empathy process where the various minority groups are beginning to think politically in a more similar way. And this might a trace of this might be exactly what we saw in 2012, where many people, both on the right and on the left, I think were surprised at how unified Latinos, African Americans, and even Asian Americans were in voting for the progressive candidate, the Democratic candidate, mm-hmm. in presidential election and also at lower levels. Of course, one variable can't explain that whole outcome. Lots of different forces were at play there. But that is maybe one sentiment that's driving the current debate and allowing for perhaps a compromise, because now both sides of the aisle see that it's quite possible that non-white groups are not thinking of themselves in this very fractured, independent way in competition with each other, but are instead starting to think of themselves as a cohesive group.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We're having a discussion about the immigration reform debate, what drives the debate, and our attitudes that fuel the debate. We are talking with Democratic State Representative Rashida Tlaib. She represents the 6th House District, basically the Southwest Detroit area, and also University of Michigan Professor of Political Science Nick Valentino, who's done a lot of study and research into really what the attitudes are that drive our immigration debate. So I really am hearing that it is not so much the economics of it, and you may take a job away. It's our culture and our sense of what is an American that causes resistance among white Americans to seeing people of all colors coming in. But I'd like to get a little more into this, why this focus seems to be so, as you found, so much on Latinos. And I know Representative Tlaib, you had mentioned there's that kind of false sense of people coming over the wall, which completely stems from the experience in the Southwest. And that has to really be hurting these other groups that are being lost in the shouting.
You know, absolutely. There's been stereotypes, and I think it's been fed through all kinds of media outlets. I mean, the image that comes about, if you watch some of the larger media outlets, when immigration reform is discussed, there is more like a Mexican national climbing over a wall. But that's not typically how people fall into the broken immigration system. Many have been living here and then their visa expires. There's just hundreds and hundreds of different types of visas and the different kinds of ways that they fall out of the immigration legalization process. So one of the things I've noticed is just in the legislature, some of the common issues like bilingual education, which has been in our state budget for decades, and it's supporting children that may grow up in a diverse home like myself who doesn't speak English when they begin school. What I hear from many of them, even on education, just bilingual education, and many of the people that benefit from there come from different kinds of ethnicities. But what you heard from my colleagues that they were focusing on Spanish-speaking children, and that they don't want to fit the bill for Spanish-speaking children. And they completely eliminated bilingual education, even though you hear the governor wanting to be more welcome to new immigrants. But even that little simple step of moving towards that shows that even as we talk about reforming our immigration system, we're going to have to talk about how do we also accommodate the fact that we need to restore bilingual education and other programs that help many families like mine integrate into the community, to help them give them that extra help that many folks in my community from Poland, from Eastern Europe to South Asian, and every single one of them have had a story about having difficulty trying to, again, integrate into the community.
As we wind up here, I'd like to get your thoughts, and I'll start with you, Professor Valentino. The kinds of stereotypes and clearly very broad and very inaccurate stereotypes that are there of undocumented immigrants, does that play into the fire behind the debate on that word amnesty, that perception that they're skating in, they're, you know, they hopped over the wall and now they've skated in, they didn't play by the rules, and now they want all the benefits of citizenship, they want their free pass? Would it be better for the debate if this idea of earned amnesty is put more to the forefront, where there will be steps that people, certainly that's contained in this framework, that people would have to report in and have to pass a criminal background check and learn English and pay taxes. So there would be that earned amnesty. Would that help the debate?
I think it might, in the sense that we know that immigration is driven by very powerful emotions that are linked to the way people feel about these specific groups, just like the representative was mentioning. And I think all of that stems from the way the media has portrayed these groups, either wittingly or unwittingly, and our politicians on both sides of the aisle have also unfortunately contributed to these negative stereotypes. So once, say, since the early 90s when we had Prop 187 in California portrayed as a means to control immigration primarily from Mexico and Central America, the image since that time in the media, according to our studies, of the problem immigrant has been predominantly the Latino. And feelings about – very strong feelings about that group dominate then, at least in our own studies, many of the reactions people have to the policy. So if we could structure the debate in a way that respected all groups of immigrants and made
and their
sure
experience, the nuances of their experiences.
And the nuances of their experiences and emphasized – one of the things that is interesting, of course, is that new immigrants are actually almost by definition very hardworking. They come long distances and in many cases take many personal risks to come here for a better life and to work. And so if that image were if we were able in our debate to hold that image of the immigrant in our mind, regardless of which country they come from, and to develop policies that encouraged and reinforced that image, then that might have a very, I think, positive impact on the kinds of policies and the support for those policies that we ultimately get.
And Representative Tlaib, you would get the last word.
Absolutely. I think that educating the general public about the fact that the system is broken, I think everybody agrees to that, but also explaining that every single person that are aspiring U.S. citizens, that they are going to follow a process, but a fair process. I think all of us want everyone to have a fair shot or opportunity, you know, to obtain that American dream. And I think everybody, when they get to those core values of our country, truly believe that comprehensive immigration reform needs to happen. These are real people with wonderful children that have, in my community alone, just contributed such a tremendous amount, from not opening local bakeries to employing local workers to bringing such rich culture and diversity. These are people that care so much about our communities and want to be part of our communities. And I think if we really believe that and want to accept that, I think that whatever process that is developed through this immigration debate, if that's the long-term goal of being able to have them be part of our communities, we'll be successful. We'll actually have a very proud immigration system we could look to and say, that's a system that's great. We have the best immigration system in the world.
Democratic State Representative Rashida Tlaib and University of Michigan Professor of Political Science Nick Valentino, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. The program today was engineered by Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Maya Friedman, and Austin Davis. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.